threw out nearly all of Divine's design work. I took over the design, Pottinger said, and Graham kept doing the story stuff, which was a full-time job, and he did a great job at that. At the same time, Ensemble's other team was also dealing with turmoil. For years now, a large chunk of the studio had been working on their dream project, the Halo MMO. The MMO wasn't exactly a secret. Microsoft knew that Ensemble wanted to make its own version of World of Warcraft, but Microsoft still hadn't given it the green light either. To some on the Xbox team, it was a surprise to find out that Ensemble had dedicated so many staff to the Halo MMO when the studio should have ostensibly been focusing on Halo Wars. It was very common for people from Microsoft to show up and go, "What the fuck is this? Why are you working on that?" said Colt McCandless. I remember there were some key meetings I was in where people were like, "We didn't know you guys were putting resources on this. We thought these resources were over there." Others dispute this, saying that Microsoft's management was well aware of how many people Ensemble had on the MMO. Soon enough, the axe came down. Microsoft made it clear to Ensemble's leadership that it had no interest in spending tens of millions on an MMO, and the project was unceremoniously canceled. "We made trade-offs," said Dave Pottinger. "Part of why we did Halo Wars was to give us a chance to do the MMO. I think, unfortunately, the MMO was going to be a huge thing, and Microsoft decided that it wasn't going to be something they wanted us to do." Some members of the MMO team split off and worked on new prototypes for a while, including a potential Age of Empires 4, while others moved over to Halo Wars. All of this drama was undoubtedly raising eyebrows at Microsoft. Ever since the original Age of Empires in 1997, there had been bouts of tension between Ensemble and its publisher. As long as Ensemble was shipping games and generating profits, those tensions would ultimately fizzle. But Ensemble hadn't released a new game since Age of Empires 3 over 2 years earlier, in 2005. All this talk about an MMO had frustrated Microsoft's executives, who were scaling back on PC gaming in favor of the red-hot Xbox 360. The Halo MMO, unlike Halo Wars, was designed for PCs. Keeping Ensemble's 100-plus staff on the payroll was starting to seem like a bad investment. "Contrary to popular belief, headcount's not completely free at Microsoft," said Shane Kim, who was a vice president in the Xbox division. "The fact of the matter was, it was sort of zero-sum, a lot of headcount. They're very expensive, and we decided we needed to deploy that in other areas." Unlike most game developers, Colt McCandless enjoyed getting to work at 6 a.m. His co-workers wouldn't typically arrive for another 4 or 5 hours, and he felt most productive when he was coding by himself, with nobody around to distract him. McCandless was responsible for some of the most complicated engineering work on Halo Wars: art tools, light shaders, multi-core threading processes. Solitude helped. One Monday in September 2008, McCandless arrived at the office at his usual time. It didn't take long for him to realize that something was off. Instead of empty desks, he found dozens of his co-workers mulling around. "I thought, wait, what the hell is going on?" he said. "What are you all doing here?" Nobody would give him a straight answer until a few hours later, when a co-worker mentioned that a bunch of Microsoft bigwigs were coming to visit. Word got around that everyone at Ensemble needed to go to the auditorium for an all-hands meeting. As they filed in, they started seeing scores of Microsoft employees, HR people, vice presidents, executives. When the whole company had gotten settled, Ensemble CEO Tony Goodman stood up front and dropped a nuclear bomb. "Tony gets on stage and says, 'We have some news,'" said Graham Devine. "Ensemble is going to be closing after Halo Wars." After 14 years and a dozen games, Ensemble's time was coming to an end. The good news, Goodman said, was that Microsoft wanted them to finish Halo Wars. Everyone at Ensemble would keep his or her job for another 4 months or so, which would give people a fair amount of time to look for new gigs. "Microsoft wanted to talk to us about keeping us all on through the end of Halo Wars," said Devine. And Tony hands it over to Microsoft to explain exactly how they were going to do that, because we'd all just gotten the news that we have no jobs after we ship this game. For 2 hours, Microsoft's representatives, including VP Shane Kim, stood in front of the room and answered questions from hurt Ensemble employees. "They're going, 'Why us?'" said Kim. "You've got Rare, you've got Lionhead, two other game studios. Surely there must be other places you can cut instead of us." Unfortunately, it's one of the darker sides of the job. Kim tried to be diplomatic, adding that Microsoft would be giving solid severance packages to those Ensemble staff who stayed until Halo Wars was out the door. Some people started crying. Others got angry. "I flipped the fuck out," said Colt McCandless. My wife and I had just gotten pregnant for the very first time, and our baby was due at the end of January, which was supposed to be the exact date the company was supposed to close. We had a newborn that was supposed to be delivered the day I was no longer supposed to have a job. Two people, the brothers Paul and David Bettner, immediately quit Ensemble and started their own studio, New Toy, which went on to make the popular Scrabble clone Words with Friends. One might say their move worked out nicely. In 2010, Zynga purchased New Toy for $53.3 million. Rich Geldreich, the graphics engineer, also left the studio shortly after hearing about the shutdown. "My brain had cracked in two," he said. "I went crazy. I just couldn't handle the fact that Ensemble imploded. It was such an awesome company. I had 5 years invested in that company, and all that technology and coding and everything, and it just was gone. And everybody was cracking around me. We were all going crazy. It was ridiculous." Soon afterward, Geldreich took a job at Valve. Those who remained at Ensemble found themselves in another uncomfortable situation. It wasn't that they'd be out of jobs in a few months. It was that some of them wouldn't be out of jobs. Tony Goodman informed everyone that he'd negotiated a contract with Microsoft as part of the closure. With this deal, he told the team, he'd be able to start an independent new studio, which he was calling Robot Entertainment. The Microsoft contract would allow them to make an online version of Age of Empires as they tried to get their business going. The problem was, Goodman had secured only enough money to hire less than half of Ensemble's current staff, and only a few people knew exactly who had made the cut. "People all of a sudden were jockeying for new jobs," said Colt McCandless. "It was madness for a while because none of us really knew what was going on. There was always this water cooler chat. Hey, did they talk to you? No, they didn't talk to you? Well, if they offered you a job, would you accept it?" Those who were invited to join Robot found out quickly, but to those who weren't getting spots, the following days were miserable. At one point, to clear the air, a manager tacked a piece of paper to the wall with a full list of Ensemble employees who would be going to Robot. Dozens of people came crowding around to see who'd made the cut. "It was like that scene in all the movies when the teacher comes out," said McCandless. "Here's who's been accepted into the cheerleading squad," and everybody rushes to the board. To many at Ensemble, this new layer of politics was making a bad situation even worse. "In our view, we saved half the jobs," said Dave Pottinger. "To whoever wasn't offered a spot at Robot, we screwed half the company over. I think we tried to do our best. We made mistakes." Other than Rich Geldreich and the Bettner brothers, everyone remained at Ensemble, despite the chaos. The severance packages helped. And over the next few months, Ensemble tried to put aside politics and the fact that their studio would be shutting down to finish Halo Wars. "The motivation was to go out on as good a note as we could," said Dave Pottinger. Ensemble staff wound up crunching for months, sleeping at their desks up until the very last minute to finish Halo Wars by the end of January, when they knew they'd all have to leave. "The thing I'm most proud of at the end was, when we announced the closure, the next day three people left," said Pottinger. "Every single other person stayed to finish the game." "We were dead men walking," said Graham Devine. "It was pretty crazy." In early 2009, Microsoft flew Devine around the world on a press tour. Traveling alongside the polarizing British designer Peter Molyneux, who's about to release the RPG Fable 2, Devine conducted interviews and showed off demos of Halo Wars. When journalists asked him about Ensemble's closure, he dodged their questions. "I remember pieces of paper being put in front of me by Microsoft telling me, 'This is what you can say,'" Devine said. For those surreal final months, Ensemble staff tried to put their internal politics aside, coming together in hopes of releasing something they could all take pride in having made. Even though they all knew the studio was closing, they kept coming into work every day. They kept crunching, and they kept doing everything they could to make Halo Wars as good as possible. "There were great days like nothing had ever happened and nothing was happening, and then there were depressing days," said Chris Rippey. "But it was a prideful group and everybody wanted to do a great job and everybody knew this was kind of the studio's legacy and wanted to do something to represent the studio properly." On February 26, 2009, Halo Wars came out. It was received fairly well, getting solid reviews from gaming sites like Eurogamer and IGN. When they look back, those who are on the Halo Wars team say they're proud to have released even a half-decent game after what they went through. Microsoft even hired a new developer, Creative Assembly, to make a sequel, Halo Wars 2, which came out in February 2017. A few studios rose from the ashes of Ensemble. There was Robot Entertainment, which went on to make Age of Empires Online and then a popular tower defense series called Orcs Must Die. A different faction of ex-Ensemble developers started a company called Bonfire, which was also purchased by Zynga, then shut down in 2013. Not to be confused with the other video game studio named Bonfire, which Blizzard's Josh Mascara co-founded in 2016. Those developers later founded yet another studio, Boss Fight Entertainment. Nearly a decade after Ensemble's closure, many of its former employees are still working together. They were a family, after all. "We hated each other, but we loved each other too," said Pottinger. Ensemble lost very few people over its run compared to any other studio. You don't have a turnover rate of... It was less than 4% or something like that. You don't have that if you don't make people happy. Back at E3 2008, just a few months before Ensemble closed its doors for good, the Halo Wars team put out a cinematic trailer that may have, in retrospect, been a subconscious cry for help. 5 years. 5 long years, the trailer's narrator said as a group of Marines fought off the invading Covenant alien forces. At first, it was going well. A group of Covenant forces descended from the sky, taking out Marine after Marine in what quickly became a bloody massacre. The narrator continued, then setback after setback, loss after loss, made what was going to be a quick and decisive win into 5 years of hell. Chapter 6 Dragon Age Inquisition. The website Consumerist once held an annual poll for Worst Company in America, asking readers to select the country's most reviled corporation through a March Madness-style elimination tournament. In 2008, as the U.S. economy collapsed, the insurance salesman at AIG took top honors. In 2011, the award went to BP, whose oil rigs had just spilled 210 million gallons of crude in the Gulf Coast. But in 2012 and 2013, a different type of company won the award, beating out the likes of Comcast and Bank of America, as over 250,000 voters flocked to declare that the United States' worst company was in fact the video game publisher Electronic Arts, EA. There were many reasons for this ignominious victory, including the rise of optional microtransaction payments in EA games and the spectacular disaster of the publisher's online-only SimCity reboot. Microtransactions, which rose to popularity in the mid-2000s thanks to publishers like EA, are in-game items, like weapons or costumes, that players can buy with real money. Few things inspire more anger from video game fans. Thanks to network issues, SimCity was essentially unplayable for days after it launched in March 2013. Even when the servers settled down and the game started working, players discovered flaws in the simulation. For example, cars would always take the shortest routes between destinations, even if those routes were full of traffic. Cops wouldn't cross intersections. Trading didn't function properly. At Kotaku, we created a special tag for the occasion, SimCity Disaster Watch. What may have rankled gamers most, however, was what they believed EA had done to BioWare. BioWare, a development studio founded in 1995 by three medical doctors who thought making games might be a cool hobby, leaped into fame in 1998 with the Dungeons & Dragons-based role-playing game Baldur's Gate, a game so influential that it would play a major role in the stories of two other games in this book, Pillars of Eternity and The Witcher 3. In the following years, BioWare became renowned for a string of top-tier RPGs like Neverwinter Nights, Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, and a space opera called Mass Effect that appealed not just to people who liked to shoot aliens, but also to people who liked to smooch them. In 2007, Electronic Arts bought BioWare, and in recent years it had seemed to fans that the studio was in a funk. BioWare's two new flagship franchises, Mass Effect and the Tolkien-ish Dragon Age, were beloved but stalling. Dragon Age 2, released in 2011, was panned for feeling incomplete. And 2012's Mass Effect 3, which put a bow on the spacefaring trilogy, angered hardcore fans with a controversial ending in which the player's choices didn't seem to matter. BioWare later released free downloadable content that expanded and added more choices to Mass Effect 3's ending. EA's labels president, Frank Gibeau, endorsed the decision. Recalled BioWare studio head Aaron Flynn, Frank once said to Mass Effect 3 lead Casey Hudson and I, "Are you sure you guys even want to do this? Are you just going to feed the trolls up there?" We're like, "No, we want to do this. We really want to get this right, do this thing." He said, "Okay, if you want to." Surely fans thought these missteps were EA's fault. The problem started when EA purchased the studio, didn't they? All you had to do was look at the long list of iconic studios that EA had acquired and then shut down, a list that included Bullfrog, Dungeon Keeper, Westwood, Command & Conquer, and Origin, Ultima, to fear that BioWare might be next. Fans went to consumerists to send a message, even if that meant declaring a video game publisher more heinous than a predatory mortgage lender. Amid these theatrics, BioWare studio head Aaron Flynn was staring down a far more relevant challenge, Dragon Age Inquisition, the third game in the Fantasy series. Inquisition was going to be the most ambitious game that BioWare had ever made. It was a game with a lot to prove, that BioWare could return to form, that EA wasn't crippling the studio, that BioWare could make an open-world RPG in which the player could move freely through massive environments. But as Flynn knew, Dragon Age Inquisition was already behind schedule thanks to unfamiliar new technology. Their new game engine, Frostbite, was requiring more work than anyone at the studio had expected. "The discovery of what's possible on a new engine is both exhilarating and humbling," Flynn wrote on BioWare's blog in September 2012, just after announcing Dragon Age Inquisition. Perhaps if he had taken a few shots of vodka beforehand, or if he didn't have to worry about what Electronic Arts PR staff would think, he might have added what BioWare staffers were really thinking. "What's possible is that the new engine is a technical disaster." BioWare's main headquarters are nestled in a small office complex near downtown Edmonton, a city best known for its enormous shopping mall and for temperatures that regularly plummet into the obscene. It's no wonder the studio came up with Dragon Age. If you want to dream up a fantasy world inhabited by fire-breathing mythical creatures, few cities are more suitable for the act than Edmonton. Dragon Age, which BioWare hoped would become the Lord of the Rings of video games, first entered development in 2002. After a hellish 7-year slog, BioWare released the series' first game, Dragon Age Origins, in November 2009. It was appealing to all types of gamers. Hardcore RPG fans dug the strategic combat and consequential choices, while the more romantically inclined loved that they could seduce their dreamy party members, like the snarky knight Alistair and the sultry wizard Morrigan. Dragon Age Origins became a massive success, selling millions of copies and, most important, inspiring hundreds of thousands of lines of fan fiction. Leading the Dragon Age development team was Mark Dara, a well-liked BioWare veteran who had been at the company since the late 1990s. Dara had a dry sense of humor and a bushy beard that had been bright red in 2013 when I first met him, but 3 years later was invaded by blotches of gray. "Mark is very good at the business of game development," said Cameron Lee, a producer at BioWare. "Internally, we call the Dragon Age team the pirate ship. It'll get where it needs to go, but it's going to go all over the place. Sail over here, drink some rum, go over here, do something else. That's how Mark likes to run his team." An alternative take from someone else who worked on the game: Dragon Age was referred to as the pirate ship because it was chaotic and the loudest voice in the room usually set the direction. I think they smartly adopted the name and morphed it into something better. After shipping Dragon Age Origins in 2009, Dara and his crew of pirates already had some ideas for the next big game. Whereas in Origins you played a fanatical Grey Warden whose life was dedicated to thwarting demons, the next Dragon Age game would be about larger-scale political conflict. Dara envisioned a game about an Inquisition. In Dragon Age lore, an autonomous organization that solves conflicts across the globe, with the player as leader and inquisitor. Then, plans changed. Progress had stalled on one of BioWare's other games, the MMO Star Wars The Old Republic. Developed at BioWare Studio in Austin, Texas, The Old Republic kept missing release dates, gradually slipping from 2009 to 2010 to 2011. Frustrated EA executives wanted a new product from BioWare to bolster their quarterly sales targets, and they decided that the Dragon Age team would have to fill the gap. After some lengthy discussions, Mark Dara and Aaron Flynn agreed to deliver Dragon Age 2 in March 2011, just 16 months after the release of Dragon Age Origins. "The Old Republic moved and there was a hole," said Dara. "Basically, Dragon Age 2 exists to fill that hole. That was the inception. It was always intended to be a game made to fit in that." Dara wanted to call it Dragon Age Exodus, which I wish we'd stuck with, but EA's marketing executives insisted that they call it Dragon Age 2, no matter what that name implied. The first Dragon Age had taken 7 years to make. Now, BioWare would have just over a year to build a sequel. For any big game, that would be difficult. For a role-playing game, it was near impossible. There were just so many variables. Dragon Age Origins had contained four giant areas, each with its own factions, monsters, and quests. Decisions the player made at the beginning of Origins, like how the character's origin story unfolded, had a significant impact on the rest of the story, which meant that BioWare's writers and designers had to build different scenes to account for every possibility. If you played as a dwarf noble who had been exiled from the labyrinthine city of Orzammar, the other dwarves would have to react accordingly upon your return. If you were a human, they wouldn't care nearly as much. None of this was achievable in a year. Even if BioWare forced everyone to work non-stop overtime on Dragon Age 2, they just wouldn't have the bandwidth to make a sequel as ambitious as fans expected. To solve this problem, Mark Dara and crew shelved the old Inquisition idea and made a risky call. Instead of taking you through multiple areas of their fantasy world, Dragon Age 2 would unfold within a single city, Kirkwall, over the course of a decade. That way, the Dragon Age team could recycle locations for many of the game's encounters, shaving months off their development time. They also axed features that had been in Dragon Age Origins, like the ability to customize your party members' equipment. It didn't pan out perfectly, but had we not made those decisions, it would have been significantly more troubled, said Mike Laidlaw, the creative director of Dragon Age. At most video game studios, the title creative director refers to the lead of a project, but EA used different nomenclature. So we made the best calls we could on a fairly tight timeline. When Dragon Age 2 came out in March 2011, players reacted poorly. They were loud about their anger, hammering the game for its tedious side quests and reused environments. Wrote one blogger, "The drop in overall quality is staggering on a cosmic level, and there's no way I'd ever recommend anyone buying this game under any circumstances." The game didn't sell as well as Dragon Age Origins, although in certain dark accounting corners of EA, it's considered a wild success, Dara said. And by the summer of 2011, BioWare had decided to cancel Dragon Age 2's expansion pack, Exalted March, in favor of a totally new game. They needed to get away from the stigma of Dragon Age 2. Really, they needed to reboot the franchise. There was something to be proven, I think, from the Dragon Age team coming off Dragon Age 2, that this was a team that could make AAA-quality good games, Dara said. There was a bit of a tone, not within the studio but around the industry, that there were essentially two tiers of BioWare. There was the Mass Effect team, and then there was everyone else. And I think there was a lot of desire to fight back against that. The Dragon Age team is a scrappy bunch. There are certain things in role-playing games we've grown to take for granted. Rare is the gamer who comes home from the store with the latest Final Fantasy, pops it into their PlayStation, and goes on Facebook to talk about what a beautiful save system it has. You won't find many reviews raving about the new Fallout's ability to properly toggle between combat and non-combat game states. Skyrim didn't sell millions because it knows how to keep track of your inventory. These systems are necessary but unglamorous, and certainly not fun to make, which is one of the reasons most video games use engines. The word engine calls to mind the guts of a car, but in game development, an engine is more like a car factory. Every time you build a new car, you'll need many of the same components. Tires, axles, plush leather seats. Similarly, just about every video game needs the same core features. A physics system, a graphics renderer, a main menu. Coding new versions of those features for every game would be like designing new wheels every time you wanted to manufacture a sedan. Engines, like factories, allow their users to recycle features and avoid unnecessary work. Even before finishing Dragon Age 2, Aaron Flynn and Mark Darrow were looking for a new engine for their fantasy franchise. Their in-house game engine, Eclipse, felt creaky and obsolete for the type of gorgeous high-end games they hoped to make. Basic cinematic effects like lens flares were impossible for Eclipse to handle. Graphically, it wasn't fully featured, Dara said. It was getting long in the tooth from that perspective. On top of that, the Mass Effect series used the third-party Unreal Engine, which made it difficult for the two BioWare teams to collaborate. Basic tasks like rendering a 3D model required a totally different process on Eclipse than they did on Unreal. "Our technology strategy was just a mess," said Flynn. "Every time we'd start a new game, people would say, we should just pick a new engine." Flynn and Dara powwowed with one of their bosses, EA executive Patrick Söderlund, and came back with a solution, the Frostbite engine, which the EA-owned studio DICE in Sweden had developed for its Battlefield games. Although nobody had ever used Frostbite to make RPGs, Flynn and Dara found it appealing for a few reasons. It was powerful, for one. DICE had a team of engineers who worked full-time on Frostbite's graphic capabilities, beefing up the visual effects that made, for example, trees sway in the wind. Because this was the video game industry, they also spent a lot of time making it look pretty to blow things up. The other big advantage of Frostbite was that EA owned it. If BioWare started developing all its games on the Frostbite engine, it could share technology with its sister studios, borrowing tools from other EA-owned developers like Visceral, Dead Space, or Criterion, Need for Speed, whenever those companies learn cool new tricks for enhancing facial capture or making it look even prettier to blow things up. In the fall of 2010, as the bulk of the Dragon Age team was finishing up DA2, Mark Dara pulled together a small group to work on a prototype they called Blackfoot. This prototype had two major goals: to start getting a feel for the Frostbite engine, and to make a free-to-play multiplayer game set in the Dragon Age universe. The latter never happened, and after a few months, Blackfoot fizzled, hinting at bigger challenges to come. It wasn't making enough progress, ultimately because its team was too small, Dara said. Frostbite's a hard engine to make progress with if your team is too small. It takes a certain number of people to just keep it on. By the end of 2011, with both Blackfoot and the Dragon Age 2 expansion pack canceled, Dara had a substantial team available to start working on BioWare's next big game. They resurfaced the old Inquisition idea and began to talk about what a Dragon Age 3 might look like on Frostbite. By 2012, they had a plan in place. Dragon Age 3, Inquisition, which later ditched the 3, would be an open-world RPG, inspired heavily by Bethesda's smash hit Skyrim. It would take place all across new areas of Dragon Age's world, and it would hit all the beats that Dragon Age 2 couldn't. My secret mission was to shock and awe the players with the massive amounts of content, said Matt Goldman, the art director. People were complaining, oh, there wasn't enough in Dragon Age 2. Okay, you're not going to say that. At the end of Inquisition, I actually want people to go, oh God, not another level. BioWare wanted Dragon Age Inquisition to be a launch title for the next generation of game consoles, the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. But EA's profit forecasters, caught up in the rise of iPad and iPhone gaming, were worried that the PS4 and Xbox One wouldn't sell very well. As a safeguard, the publisher insisted that they also ship on the older PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360, both of which were already in tens of millions of homes. Most early PS4 Xbox One games followed the same strategy, except for a certain Polish RPG that we'll cover in Chapter 9. With personal computers added to the mix, this meant Inquisition would have to ship on 5 platforms at once, a first for BioWare. Ambitions were piling up. This was to be BioWare's first 3D open-world game and their first game on Frostbite, an engine that had never been used to make RPGs. It needed to be made in roughly 2 years, it needed to ship on 5 platforms, and, oh yeah, it needed to help restore the reputation of a studio that had been beaten up pretty badly. Basically, we had to do new consoles, a new engine, new gameplay, build the hugest game that we've ever made, and build it to a higher standard than we ever did, said Matt Goldman, with tools that don't exist. If an engine is like a car factory, then in 2012, as Inquisition entered development, the Frostbite engine was like a car factory without the proper assembly lines. Before Dragon Age Inquisition, developers at EA had used Frostbite mostly to make first-person shooters like Battlefield and Medal of Honor. Frostbite's engineers had never built tools that would, say, make the main character visible to the player. Why would they need to? In first-person shooters, you see through the character's eyes. Your body consists of disembodied hands, a gun, and, if you're really lucky, some legs. Battlefield didn't need RPG stats, magical spells, or even save systems. The campaign kept track of your progress with automatic checkpoints. As a result, Frostbite couldn't create any of those things. It was an engine that was designed to build shooters, said Dara. We had to build everything on top of it. At first, the Dragon Age team underestimated just how much work this would be. Characters need to move and walk and talk and put on swords, and those swords need to do damage when you swing them, and you need to be able to press a button to swing them, said Mike Laidlaw. Frostbite could do some of that, Laidlaw added, but not all of it. Dara and his team knew that they were the Frostbite guinea pigs, that they were exchanging short-term pain for long-term benefits, but during early development on Dragon Age Inquisition, even the most basic tasks were excruciating. Frostbite didn't yet have the tools they needed to make an RPG. Without those tools in place, a designer had no idea how long it might take to do something as fundamental as making areas. Dragon Age Inquisition was supposed to allow the player to control a party of 4 people, but that system wasn't in the game yet. How could a level designer figure out where to place obstacles on a map if he couldn't test it out with a full party of characters? Even when Frostbite's tools did start functioning, they were finicky and difficult to use. John Epler, a cinematic designer, recalled one internal demo for which he had to go through a Sisyphean ritual just to build a cutscene. I had to get to the conversation in-game, open my tools at the same time, and then as soon as I hit the line, I had to hit the pause button really, really quickly, Epler said, because otherwise it would just play through to the next line. Then I had to add animations, and then I could scrub it two or three times before it would crash, and then I'd have to start the process all over again. It was absolutely the worst tools experience I've ever had. The Frostbite team at DICE spent time supporting Epler and the other designers, answering their questions and fixing bugs, but their resources were limited. It didn't help that Sweden was 8 hours ahead of Edmonton. If one of BioWare's designers had a question for DICE in the afternoon, it could take a full day before they heard an answer. Since creating new content in Frostbite was so difficult, trying to evaluate its quality became impossible. At one point, Patrick Weeks, a writer, had finished a scene between several characters and inserted it into the game. He then took it to some of BioWare's leads for one of their standard quality reviews. When they turned on the game, they discovered that only the main character could talk. The engine would not hook up the non-player character lines, Weeks said. You would say something, and then it would go blip, 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 and then you would say something again, and you'd go, okay, I don't know if I can judge the level of quality without any of the words that happen. Engine updates made this process even more challenging. Every time the Frostbite team updated the engine with new fixes and features, BioWare's programmers would have to merge it with the changes they'd made to the previous version. They'd have to go through the new code and copy-paste all the older stuff they'd built, inventory, save files, characters, then test it all out to ensure they hadn't broken anything. They couldn't find a way to automate the process, so they had to do it manually. It was debilitating, said Cameron Lee. There'd be times when the build wouldn't work for a month, or it was unstable as hell. Because the new version of the engine would come in, the tools team would start doing the integration. All the while, the team is still working and moving ahead, so it gets worse and worse and worse. The art department, meanwhile, was having a blast. For all its weaknesses as an RPG engine, Frostbite was the perfect tool for creating big, gorgeous environments, and the studio's artists took advantage to build out the dense forests and murky swamps that would populate Dragon Age Inquisition. Under Matt Goldman's shock-and-awe approach, BioWare's environment artists spent months making as much as possible, taking educated guesses when they didn't yet know what the designers needed. The environment art came together quicker than any other aspect of the game, said the lead environment artist, Ben McGrath. For a long time, there was a joke on the project that we'd made a fantastic-looking screenshot generator, because you could walk around these levels with nothing to do. You could take great pictures. Great pictures didn't make for much of a video game, though. Mike Laidlaw, who headed the story and gameplay teams, had been working with the writers and designers to come up with basic beats for Dragon Age Inquisition. Sketching out the story wasn't too hard. They knew the player would organize and lead an Inquisition of like-minded soldiers. They knew the big bad would be a demonic wizard named Corypheus. And they knew that, as always, there would be a crew of companions that the player could recruit and seduce. But the concept of Dragon Age Inquisition as an open-world game was stymieing Laidlaw and his team. The art team had constructed all these sprawling landscapes, but what were players going to do there? One idea that BioWare never quite took seriously, rideable dragons. EA's CEO John Riccitiello told us, we should have the ability to ride dragons, said Mark Dara. That would make it sell 10 million copies. Dragon Age Inquisition did not have rideable dragons. And how could BioWare ensure that Inquisition's giant world remained fun to explore after dozens of hours? In an ideal world, a big project like Dragon Age Inquisition would have a dedicated team of system designers who were solely responsible for solving those problems. They devise quests, activities, and all the other encounters that could keep players entertained while exploring Inquisition's massive world. They try to envision what designers call the core gameplay loop. What does a 30-minute play session look like? And then they'd keep prototyping and iterating until that gameplay felt good. In the real world, Laidlaw and his team didn't have time for that. Frostbite wouldn't allow it. As they plugged away at the game, Inquisition's designers found that they couldn't test out new ideas because so many basic features were missing. Was there enough stuff to do in each area of the game? The camera wasn't working, so they couldn't tell. Were the quests interesting enough? They couldn't answer that yet because their combat system didn't exist. Laidlaw's crew came up with the abstract idea that the player, as the Inquisitor, would roam the world solving problems and building some level of power or influence that he or she could then use to affect events on a global scale. Yet for a very long time, it remained unclear how that would look in the game. The team played around with the idea of influence as a currency, like gold, but that system didn't seem to click.
It really could have used more small-scale refinement and testing, and let's try three different ways of doing this, Laidlaw said.
Instead, we said, let's build some levels and let's hope we can figure this out as we go.
One day in late 2012, after a year of strained development on Inquisition, Mark Dara asked Mike Laidlaw to go to lunch.
We're walking out to his car, Laidlaw said, and I think he might have had a bit of a script in his head. Dara said, all right, I don't actually know how to approach this, so I'm just going to say it. On a scale of 1 to apocalyptic, how upset would you be if I said the player could be, I don't know, a Kunari Inquisitor? Laidlaw was baffled. They decided that the player could be only a human in Inquisition. Adding other playable races like the horned Kunari that Darrow was asking for would mean they'd need to quadruple their budget for animation, voice acting, and scripting. I went, I think we could make that work, Laidlaw said, asking Darrow if he could have more budget for dialogue. Dara answered that if Laidlaw could make playable races happen, he couldn't just have more dialogue. He could have an entire extra year of production. Laidlaw was thrilled. Fuck, yeah, okay, he recalled saying. As it turned out, Mark Dara had already determined that it would be impossible to finish Dragon Age Inquisition in 2013. The game was too big, and they had underestimated the length of too many tasks because of their Frostbite issues. To make Inquisition as good an open-world RPG as Dara and his crew imagined it could be, they'd have to delay it at least another year. Dara was in the process of putting together a pitch for EA. Let BioWare delay the game, and in exchange, it'd be even bigger and better than anyone at EA had envisioned. Sitting in a second-floor conference room overlooking the hotel promenade that shared a building with BioWare, Dara and his leads hashed out an outline of new marketing points that included mounts, a sleek new tactical camera, and the big one, playable races. They put together what they called peelable scope proposals. Here was what they could do with an extra month. Here was what they could do with 6 more months. Here was what they could do with a year. And worst case scenario, here were all the things they'd have to cut if EA wouldn't let them delay Dragon Age Inquisition at all. One day in March 2013, Mark Dara and BioWare studio boss Aaron Flynn took an early flight to the EA offices in Redwood Shores, California. They were confident that EA would give them some leeway, but it was still nerve-wracking, especially in the wake of EA's recent turmoil. The publisher had just parted ways with its CEO, John Riccitiello, and had recruited a board member, Larry Probst, to keep the seat warm while it hunted for a new top executive. It was impossible to know how Probst would react to BioWare's request. Delaying Dragon Age Inquisition would affect EA's financial projections for that fiscal year, which was never good news. Ever wondered why so many big video games come out in March? There's an easy answer for that. The fiscal year used for reporting financial performance to stockholders, which dominates the decision-making of every publicly traded company. Most game publishers end their fiscal years on March 31st, so if they're looking to delay a game but still fit it in the current fiscal year, March makes for the perfect window. Dara and Flynn arrived at EA's headquarters first thing in the morning. As they walked in, the first person they saw was their new boss, Larry Probst. We walked in with Larry, and then we ended up leaving at the end of the day with him as well, which I think made a good impression on him, Dara said. The meeting lasted around 2 hours. You're talking over scenarios, you're talking over impact on finances, Dara said. There's some yelling. Maybe it was a convincing pitch, or maybe it was the executive turmoil. Maybe the specter of Dragon Age 2 had an effect on Probst and crew, or maybe it was that EA didn't like being called the worst company in America. An internet poll wasn't exactly causing EA stock to plummet, but winning the Consumerist Award 2 years in a row had made a tangible impact on the publisher's executives, leading to some feisty internal meetings about how EA could repair its image. Whatever the reasons, EA greenlit the delay. Moving Dragon Age Inquisition back a year might hurt Q3 earnings, but if it led to a better game, that would be a win for everyone. I first saw Dragon Age Inquisition in a lavish suite at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in downtown Seattle. It was August 2013, and the next day BioWare planned to show the game to fans at the Penny Arcade Expo, PAX, next door, so the studio had invited journalists to get a preemptive peek. Sipping from a complimentary water bottle, I watched Mark Dara and Mike Laidlaw play through a beautiful 30-minute demo set across two war-torn regions called Crestwood and the Western Approach. In the demo, the player-controlled Inquisitor would rush to defend a keep from invading forces, burn down boats to prevent enemy soldiers from escaping, and capture a fortress for the Inquisition. It all looked fantastic. None of it made it into Dragon Age Inquisition. That demo, like many of the sizzling trailers we see at shows like E3, was almost entirely fake. By the fall of 2013, the Dragon Age team had implemented many of Frostbite's parts, the tires, the axles, the gears, but they still didn't know what kind of car they were making. Laidlaw and crew had scripted the PAX demo by hand, entirely based on what BioWare thought might be in the game. Most of the levels and art assets were real, but the gameplay was not. "We did not have that benefit of rock-solid prototypes," said Laidlaw. "Part of what we had to do is go out early and try to be transparent because of Dragon Age 2, and just say, look here, it's the game, it's running live, it's at PAX. Because we wanted to make that statement that we're here for fans." Dragon Age 2 hung on the team like a shadow, haunting Laidlaw and other leads as they tried to figure out which gameplay mechanics would work best for Inquisition. Even after the PAX showing, they had trouble sticking to one vision. "There was insecurity. I think that's a function of coming out of a rough spell," said Laidlaw. "Which of the things that were called out on Dragon Age 2 were a product of time, and which were just a bad call? Which things should we reinvent because we have an opportunity moving into this? It leads to a ton of uncertainty." There were debates over combat. Should they iterate on the fast-paced action of Dragon Age 2, or go back to the tactical focus of Origins? And many, many arguments over how to populate the wilderness areas. In the months after PAX 2013, the BioWare team ditched much of what they'd shown during that demo, like boat burning and keep capturing. For years, video game developers have struggled with the question of what to put in demos. Is it lying to fans if an E3 feature never makes it into the final game? It's a nuanced topic. "When people get really mad, 'Well, you showed this and the final game wasn't like this,'" said Mark Dara. "We think, 'Well, it was supposed to be,' or 'We thought it was going to be.'" Even small features like the search tool went through dozens of permutations. Because Dragon Age Inquisition didn't have a proper pre-production phase in which the designers could fool around with prototypes and discard the ones that didn't work, Laidlaw found himself stretched thin. He had to make impulsive decisions. "I'm sure depending on who you ask, there are members of my team who would say, 'Wow, I think we did a good job in a rough situation,'" said Laidlaw. "And others who would say, 'That Mike guy is a giant asshole.'" Previous BioWare games had been big, but none were as massive as this. By the end of 2013, the Dragon Age Inquisition team comprised more than 200 people, with dozens of additional outsourced artists in Russia and China. Every department had its own leads, but nobody worked in a vacuum. If a writer wanted to pen a scene about two dragons fighting, she would have to take it to the design team for a layout, then to the art team for modeling, and then to the cinematics team to make sure the cameras all pointed at the right places. They needed animation, otherwise the two dragons would just stand there staring at one another. Then there was audio, visual effects, and quality assurance. Coordinating all this work was a full-time job for several people. "It was a real challenge to get everyone working in the same direction," said Shane Hawko, the lead character artist. "I think to get more specific on the complexities at this scale of game development, it's the dependencies," said Aaron Flynn. "It's the things that have to happen for the other things to work and be successful." The common term in game development circles is blocking, which describes when a developer can't get work done because he or she is waiting for someone else to send over some integral art asset or piece of code. "Okay, well, I was going to do this today, but I can't because we have a crash, so I'm going to go to this other thing," said Flynn. Good developers are constantly juggling these little tasks on a daily level. Blocking was always an issue, but as engineers at both BioWare and DICE added more and more features to Frostbite, work on Dragon Age Inquisition became significantly less tedious. Tools started functioning properly, levels began to shape up. People on the Dragon Age team who had been slowed down by Frostbite before, such as the systems designers, were finally able to implement and test ideas in the open world. They were running out of time, though, and another delay was off the table. Every year at Christmas, each team at BioWare would send out a build of its game for the entire studio to play over the holiday break. Whichever game was closest to release became top priority, and over Christmas 2013, that game was Dragon Age Inquisition. Dara and his team spent long hours in November and December piecing together a playable version of the game. It didn't need to be perfect or polished. After all, nobody outside EA would see it. But Dara saw it as an opportunity to size things up. This year's build would be narrative playable. People could play through the whole story, but big chunks were missing. And sometimes instead of a new quest, the game would just display big text boxes that described what was supposed to happen. When the rest of BioWare had played the demo and came back to the Dragon Age team with their feedback, Dara realized that they were in trouble. There were big complaints about the story. Some of the feedback was that the game didn't really make a lot of sense and the motivations for the player weren't very logical, said Cameron Lee. At the beginning of Inquisition, a massive explosion would tear a hole in the veil, a magical border that separated the real world from the dreamlike Fade. In Dragon Age lore, this was bad news. The original version of Inquisition's story allowed the player to close this rift and officially take the mantle of Inquisitor during the prologue, which was causing some hang-ups. It didn't do the story help, said Lee, because you've closed the rift, so what's the urgency to keep going? The writers knew that fixing this problem would add extra hours to everyone's days, but what else could they do? Embarking on a mission that they called Operation Sledgehammer, the writers revised the entire first act of Dragon Age Inquisition, adding and tweaking scenes so that the player would have to go out and recruit aid from one of the game's warrior factions, the Mages or Templar, before closing the rift and becoming the Inquisitor. Sledgehammer didn't destroy the story entirely, it just meant that you had to break some bones in order to reset them in the right kind of way, said Lee. This happens very often in game development. The other big piece of negative feedback from the holiday build was that the battles just weren't fun. In January 2014, in hopes of solving this problem, Daniel Kading, BioWare's lead encounter designer, began an experiment. Kading had recently joined the company after 12 years at Relic, a Vancouver-based studio best known for strategy games like Dawn of War, and he'd brought with him a rigorous new method for testing combat in video games. Kading went to BioWare's leadership with a proposal. Give him the authority to call up the entire Inquisition team once a week for an hour, 4 weeks in a row, for mandatory play sessions. The lead said yes. So Kading opened his own little laboratory, working with the other designers to construct a set of combat encounters that the rest of the team could test out. Because Dragon Age's battles were comprised of so many factors, player abilities, stats, monster strength, positioning, and so on, Kading saw his experiment as an opportunity to pinpoint where the problems were. After each session, the testers would have to fill out surveys about their experiences. Whereas the holiday build had been wide-ranging, this was laser-focused. When surveys came back during the first week of Kading's experiment, the average rating was a dismal 1.2 out of 10. Somehow that was comforting to the Inquisition gameplay team. Morale took an astonishing turn for the better that very week, Kading said. It's not that we could recognize the problems, it was that we weren't shirking from them. Over the next week, Kading and his team made several small tweaks to combat abilities, boosting cooldowns and changing animation speeds based on the feedback they'd received. The individual responses came through in fits and starts, Kading said. Winter's grasp is much better now that it's a 4-second freeze instead of a 2-second freeze. This encounter was so much cooler now that I could wall off the behemoth reliably. 4 weeks later, when Kading's experiment had finished, the average rating was an 8.8. As 2014 went on, the Dragon Age Inquisition team made significant progress, although many of them wished they didn't have to ship on those clunky old consoles. The PS4 and Xbox One were both significantly more powerful than their predecessors, particularly when it came to system memory, RAM, which is what allows a game to keep track of everything happening on screen. Confusingly, we also refer to the amount of space on a hard drive as memory, because computers like to make everything more complicated than it needs to be. The PS3 and Xbox 360, which were running on graphics technology from 2004 and 2005, just weren't doing the job. A console's RAM is sort of like a bucket. Displaying characters, objects, and scripts in a game is like adding varying amounts of water to the bucket, and if you overfill it, your game will slow to a crawl or even crash. The PS4's and Xbox One's buckets were nearly 16 times as big as those of the PS3 and Xbox 360. But early on, Dara and Laidlaw had decided not to add features to the next-gen versions that wouldn't be possible on the last-gen versions. They didn't want playing Inquisition on the PS3 and 360 to feel like playing a different game. That limited how much water they could put into their bucket, which meant the team had to find creative solutions. A lot of what we do is well-intentioned fakery, said Patrick Weeks, pointing to a late quest called Here Lies the Abyss. When you assault the fortress, you have a big cutscene that has a lot of Inquisition soldiers and a lot of Grey Wardens on the walls.
And then anyone paying attention or looking for it as you're fighting through the fortress will go, wow, I'm only actually fighting 3 to 4 guys at a time, and there are almost never any Inquisition soldiers with me. Because in order for that to actually work on the PS3 and Xbox 360, you couldn't have too many different character types on the screen. I probably should have tried harder to kill the last-gen version of the game, said Aaron Flynn. It turned out that the safety net of older consoles wasn't even necessary. EA and other big publishers had severely underestimated how successful the PS4 and Xbox One would be. Both new consoles sold gangbusters in 2013 and 2014, and the last-gen versions of Inquisition wound up composing just 10% of the game's sales, according to Mark Dara. Though the Dragon Age team was making progress, and they'd all become more comfortable with Frostbite, parts of the game were still way behind schedule. Because the tools had started functioning so late in the process, and because Inquisition was such a massive, complicated game, the team wasn't able to implement some basic features until the very last minute. We were 8 months from ship before we could get all of the party members in the party, said Patrick Weeks, who was trying to playtest the much-loved companion Iron Bull, when he realized there was no way to recruit Iron Bull. I went, wait, we're 8 months from ship, and no one in the world has ever played the game with Iron Bull in their party? So I have no idea if any line where he's supposed to say something, any line of banter, no idea if any of that is actually firing right. And it wasn't laziness on anyone's part, it's just reality. You're trying to make an engine. All of the programmers and scripters are at the time literally building the world. Because everything was so far behind, the Dragon Age team could identify only some of Inquisition's flaws during the last few months of development. Trying to determine the game's flow and pacing before that period was like trying to test drive a car with 3 wheels. You write the story and you do a review and you go, okay, we'll change some things, said Mark Dara. And then you put it in and you do a white box. A white box is an outline of a game's level without any art assets attached, used for quick testing and prototypes. At some studios, it's called a gray box. At others, it's called a black box. That even a concept as simple as this has no standardized name says a great deal about the youth of the video game industry. You're running around a level, and it's okay. And then you get the voice acting in, and you go, actually, this doesn't work. It's totally terrible. Time was running out, and BioWare couldn't delay Inquisition another year. They needed to deliver this game in the fall of 2014. This left Dara and his team with 2 options. Option 1 was to settle for an incomplete game full of rough drafts and untested ideas. In a post-DA2 world, that wasn't an appealing thought. They couldn't disappoint fans again. They needed to take the time to revise and polish every aspect of Inquisition. I think Dragon Age Inquisition is a direct response to Dragon Age 2, said Cameron Lee. Inquisition was bigger than it needed to be. It had everything but the kitchen sink in it, to the point where we went too far. I think that having to deal with Dragon Age 2 and the negative feedback we got on some parts of that was driving the team to want to put everything in and try to address every little problem or perceived problem. The other option was to crunch. The Dragon Age team had gone through various periods of extended overtime during Inquisition's development, but this would be the worst yet. It would mean months of never-ending late nights and weekends in the office. It would lead to, as Shane Hawko put it, a lot of lost family time. I would love to have no crunch ever, said Aaron Flynn. I think it remains to be seen whether crunching actually works. Obviously, a ton of literature says it doesn't, but I think everybody finds a time in their development careers where you're going, I don't see what options we have. John Epler, the cinematic designer, recalled a bleary-eyed ritual in which every night he'd drive to the same convenience store, pick up a bag of Cheetos, and then go home and zone out in front of the television. You get to the point where you've been at work for 12 or 14 hours, you get on the road home and you think, all I really want to do is watch a TV show I've watched 100 times and eat junk food I've eaten 100 times, because those things are comfortable, and I know how they're going to end, Epler said. Whereas every day is another something coming to the top of the pile and, oh shit, somebody needs to look at this. When the store's clerk started to recognize him, Epler realized he needed a lifestyle adjustment. As they crunched through 2014, Dara and crew finally finished off the features they wished they'd been able to nail down back in the first year of development. They completed the power system, which would allow the players to build up influence for the Inquisition by roaming around the world and solving problems. They filled Inquisition's deserts and swamps with side quests, hidden treasures, and astrological puzzles. Ideas that weren't working, like reactive environments, destroyable ladders, mud that sticks to your shoes, were promptly removed.
The writers blew up and rewrote the prologue at least 6 times, by one producer's count, although they didn't have time to give nearly as much attention to the ending. Just a few months before the game shipped, they added some features that would turn out to be pivotal, like a jump button that would let the Inquisitor hop over fences and gradually scale mountains, through the time-tested video game tradition of leaping against the side of a mountain over and over until you make it up. The team had originally scheduled Inquisition for October, but by the summer they'd bumped it back another 6 weeks for what game developers call polish, the phase of development in which a game's content and features are complete and all that remains is optimization and bug fixing. Dragon Age Inquisition had about 99,000 bugs on it, said Mark Dara. That's the actual number. That requires a lot of context because we file qualitative and quantitative bugs, so things like, oh, I was kind of bored at this point, that's a bug. The number of bugs on an open-world game, I've never seen anything like it, said Ben McGrath, the lead environment artist. But they're also easy to fix, so keep filing those bugs and we'll keep fixing them. For BioWare, it was far harder to discover them all. It required creative experimentation from the Quality Assurance, QA, team, who spent what felt like endless late nights testing everything from the intricacies of the crafting system to whether you could jump off the edge of a mountain and fall through the environment. During those last few months, the writer Patrick Weeks would take builds of Inquisition home and let his 9-year-old son play around with the game. His son was obsessed with mounting and dismounting the horse, which Weeks found amusing. One night, Weeks' son came up and said he'd been killed by a bunch of spiders, which seemed strange. His son's characters were too high a level to be dying to spiders. Confused, Weeks loaded up the game, and sure enough, a group of spiders had annihilated his son's party. After some poking around, Weeks figured out the problem. If you dismounted the horse in the wrong place, all your companion's gear would disappear. It was because my son liked the horse so much more than anyone else had ever or will ever like the horse, Weeks said. I doubt we would have seen it because it takes spamming the button to figure out there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that if you're in the right place, it's going to wipe out your party members. Mark Dara, who was responsible for steering the Dragon Age Inquisition pirate ship into its final port, had a knack for knowing which bugs were worth fixing, like the one where you could jump on your dwarf party member's head to get to areas that shouldn't be accessible, and which weren't, like the ones where your weapon's graphic would clip through walls. On an open-world RPG of this scope and scale, it would be impractical and take way too much time to fix every possible bug, so they had to prioritize. It helped that the Dragon Age team was full of veterans and that over the years they developed a fair amount of chemistry as a team. Muscle memory is incredibly influential at this point, said Cameron Lee. Through the hellfire which is game development, we're forged into a unit, in that we know what everyone's thinking, and we understand everyone's expectations, and we know what needs to get done, and just do it. Eventually, they did it. On November 18th, 2014, BioWare launched Dragon Age Inquisition, successfully shipping the game despite Frostbite's many challenges. I think at launch we still didn't actually have all our tools working, said Mark Dara. We had our tools working enough. Almost immediately, Inquisition became the best-selling Dragon Age game, beating EA's sales expectations in just a few weeks. The combat was fun, if occasionally too chaotic. The environments were beautiful, and the companions were fantastic, thanks to top-notch writing and voice acting, including a breakout performance by the former teen heartthrob Freddie Prinze Jr. as Iron Bull. One standout scene, which unfolded right after the player's home base was destroyed, depicted the tattered remnants of the Inquisitor's army, singing a hopeful song in unison, "The Dawn Will Come." Dragon Age Inquisition was, in many ways, a triumphant game. Look closely enough, however, and you can find lingering remnants of Inquisition's chaotic development. One of the first things you'd see in the game was an area called the Hinterlands, a quilt of forests and farms that served as Dragon Age's first open-world environment. The Hinterlands was full of fetch quests, garbage quests, Dara called them, that would send you off to deliver herbs and kill throngs of wolves. They were serviceable time wasters, but they felt like chores compared with Inquisition's fascinating main story. The problem was, too many people weren't going out and seeing the main story. Some players didn't realize they could leave the Hinterlands and return to their home base of Haven to trigger the next main story quest. Other players got stuck in a weird compulsive gratification loop, forcing themselves to do every side quest in the Hinterlands before leaving. One of my more popular Kotaku articles during the week of Dragon Age Inquisition's launch was titled, "PSA, if you're playing Dragon Age, leave the Hinterlands." Internet commenters rushed to blame those damn lazy developers for this problem, but really, it was the natural consequence of Inquisition's struggles. Had the Dragon Age team miraculously received another year to make the game, or if they'd had the opportunity to spend years building up Frostbite's tools before starting development, maybe those quests would have been more interesting. Maybe they would have been less tedious. Maybe they'd have had more twists and complications, like the ones found in The Witcher 3 just a few months later. The challenge of the Hinterlands and what it represented to the opening 10 hours of Dragon Age is exactly the struggle of learning to build open-world gameplay and mechanisms when you are a linear narrative story studio, said Aaron Flynn. For BioWare, Dragon Age Inquisition was nonetheless a victory. Aaron Flynn, Mark Dara, and the rest of the Dragon Age team had succeeded.